Accession number 17993, Reel 3.
Gordon Eagle-Schweiger, Reel 3.
Yes, this exercise was to fight the Battle of Britain, having written, or rather advised Goering how to fight what became known as the Battle of Britain, from the point of view you had the capabilities of the RAF, its air defence system, its anti-aircraft, its balloons, its radar, which was then known as Chain Home Low, Chain Home Extra Low, and of course the capabilities of the German attacking bombers and fighters. You had to divorce yourself from any knowledge of history of the Battle of Britain and do it exactly as though you were a colonel on Goering's staff and tell him how you should go about it. This led to, you had a fortnight for this exercise, which you needed, I can assure you. One student actually produced his whole paper in German, thinking he might get away with that, but regrettably one of the directing staff also spoke German and sent his comments back in German. But it's a lot of controversy whether it should be the airfields you should attack, whether you should attack the aircraft factories, whether you should attack cities and so on. Anyway, that was fascinating. There were a number of extremely good exercises like that. The course lasted a year, and at the end of that year I hoped to have a flying job, but unfortunately that was not to be, as they were getting fewer and fewer in the Air Force, and I was posted to the Far East again, to headquarters Far East Air Force at Changi, as an air plans officer. A wonderful posting. I very much wanted to go to Singapore, and I was lucky enough to get that job, albeit not a flying one.
Work as what, did you say?
Air plans. I had two main roles. The first one was to update all the plans for the evacuations of British citizens from all the various countries in the Far East, which there were a great many, how we would organise the transport or whatever it was to get these people out in the event of some sort of hostilities. The second but more important role was to plan for the reinforcement of the Far East Air Force under SEATO, Southeast Asia Treaty Organisation, and this involved extending runways, strengthening taxiways, building air electronics centres and so on. And this was an interesting job, and I had heard of the use by the admiral who was in charge of the building the first US nuclear submarine program, of a technique of what amounts to pictorial analysis called project and evaluation and review technique, network analysis in other words. And so I studied this for a while and introduced it as a planning tool. Essentially what it does, it makes sure that you do things when you have to do them, but you don't do them when you don't have to do them. So if you're building a house, you don't have all the bricks delivered on site and paid for until you put the foundations in, for example. So another colleague who is an engineering officer in the RAF and I drew up networks for all considerable re-equipment in SEATO. We had just about completed the project when there was yet another defence review called, and it was all put on the back burner for some weeks. Defence review was eventually completed, and we had another set of objectives to plan for, and we did it all over again. And would you believe it, there was yet another defence review, and SEATO was effectively abandoned, and we effectively abandoned the Far East.
What date have we reached now, approximately?
We're now up to 1967. If I might go back a little bit in time, to my time at the Air Ministry, one of the things I did was to go with Duncan Simpson, one of the Hawker test pilots, to the Middle East and the Far East, looking at the sort of airfields that the P-1127 might operate from. We went up country in north of Aden, so these sand strips. We also went into Borneo. During the time, our time in Borneo, of course, there was confrontation going on with Indonesia, and there was a bit of fighting on the border. And we were dropped off at these remote jungle strips. They were only strips, which had been originally developed by, or redeveloped by the Japanese during the war. And then a light aircraft, quite often an army aircraft of some sort, would then depart and leave us two in the middle of the jungle. We were at one place. We were taking soil samples and measuring the length of the strip and the width and so on. And some shooting started, and we thought our number was up and we'd finish up as prisoners in Indonesia, but it turned out to be a Gurkha patrol coming out of the jungle, just letting off a few rounds for fun. And also, the commander of this patrol, one of the Gurkha regiments, was an old school friend of Duncan Simpson's, so we were welcomed back to their campsite for breakfast of tin sausage and so on, you know, the usual thing. However, revert to the Far East. Another role I had was to attend the briefing of the commander Far East Forces, General Carver, and brief him on the air activity during the week by the Far East Air Force. We were still engaged in this confrontation in Indonesia, so there was once some activity going on. At the end of all that, I began to be more and more disillusioned, I'm afraid, with the RAF. Not from a personal point of view directly, but because I felt that the scuttling, if I might use that word, of the P-1154 and the AW-681, despite vehement support for it from the Air Force, the scuttling without a fight was really unfortunate and not something I particularly want to be associated with. I then saw the rundown of the RAF with various redundancy schemes, though I could see that I would have a secure future in the RAF, but I wished to stay. My prospect of flying again was precisely zero. So under the scheme introduced by Sir James Grigg some years before, I had the option at the age of 38 or 16 years service of deciding to stay or go. If I were to go, then I would get a small pension immediately and I could take up a second career. I decided I would do that for the reasons I've just given, and I did discover in the regulations that I could request a posting to a specific airfield during my last 6 months of service, which was end on the 24th of June 1968. So I selected Little Rissington in Gloucestershire, near my home at Broadway, and they said, well, that's lucky, because the Queen Mother, who is the Honorary Air Commodore of the Central Flying School, would be paying a visit, and you're just the chap to go and organise it. So off I went to Little Rissington, but unfortunately, it seems to follow me around this, the visit was cancelled when I'd been there about 2 or 3 weeks, and my immediate boss said, well, there's not much point in your hanging around here, there's nothing for you to do, go home, and if we need you to do anything, we'll give you a call, but I don't think they ever did. So I served my last 6 months effectively being at home. So then we come to a change of career, non-military.
What was your own personal opinion of TSR2?
At the time, I felt it to be a significant and important weapon system, obviously. I think, looking back on it, it was probably designed for a role which the UK probably, in hindsight, didn't have. It was unfortunate that the Americans were producing their own similar aircraft, the F-111. It was unfortunate that the other nation that could have had an interest in the aircraft, that is the Royal Australian Air Force, elected to go for the F-111. But it was a magnificent achievement. Its weapon systems, of course, developments of them are used in Tornado, and a lot of the aerodynamic design, particularly in air intake design, and the engines were developed and used in Concorde. So all that research was not entirely wasted. I think at the time I firmly believed it was a magnificent aeroplane, and indeed I think the trials that were done with those that were built probably showed that to be true.
Just going back to Korea, did you find the Australian Air Force much different in its methods from the RAF?
Yes, very much so, very much more informal. Christian name terms from all your ground crew, for example, or mate. regrettably, some of the Australians were very anti-Pommy. I think, understandably, in that when we arrived, we took over all the jobs, apart from squadron commander. The two flight commanders were RAF. I was the pilot attack and interceptor instructor, and so on. And I think they rather resented this. But as I've said, I think earlier in this piece, that they had run out of their own people, effectively. I think that they resented that, and there was a little bit of Pommy bashing that went on. But nonetheless, they were a highly efficient outfit, and I was very fortunate and so on to be a member of that squadron.
And to what extent was there enemy opposition on the operations that you did?
Apart from ground fire, none at all. We didn't really go far enough north to be bothered by the MiGs, which was just as well, because the Meteor would be no match for a MiG-15. We did have quite a lot of anti-aircraft fire. In fact, my aircraft was actually hit on one occasion. Rather surprised me. And a colleague of mine, John Coleman, actually was hit by an anti-aircraft shell which lodged in the cockpit of his Meteor, jammed his throttle wide open, and jammed his undercarriage up and his air brakes fully closed, but didn't fortunately go off. So he had no alternative but to go as fast as he could, or had no option to go as fast, back over the bomb line, and then used his ejection seat and bailed out. And as we landed from this operation, where we'd been bombing somewhere in North Korea, the helicopter landed, and out got John Coleman and joined the queue going into operations for debriefing. We used to be attacked at night by PO2s, which were a light biplane made principally of wood and canvas with very little metal, and therefore the highly sophisticated American radar air defense system didn't pick them up, and they used to come futtering over, and they literally dropped small bombs over the side of the aircraft, and the American anti-aircraft system would then open up and just fire blind into the sky, which is the most extraordinary noise, as you can imagine. On the first occasion that these people came over, I thought, I'd better do something about this. I grabbed my tin hat, jumped into a slit trench, this is at night, mark you, and discovered that it was full of water. So then I discovered I hadn't been joined by everybody else, because everybody else had gone to the bar. So I thought, well, I'd better do what the other chaps do. But that was the standard practice when the alert went off. Retired to the squadron bar, and they had a radio, and we could listen to the air interception going on. The Americans then were using Banshees off a carrier to try and shoot these PO2s down, but the Banshee just couldn't go slow enough, and they lost a few by mid-air collisions. They didn't think that was worth it, so they then got a T6 Harvard, equipped it with a radar package under one wing and a gun under the other, and this aircraft goes slow enough, and they managed to shoot a few of them down. Their operations stopped after the peace treaty. The T6 Texan was also used by the American for artillery spotting and target marking. So even though it was a pretty old airplane, it still had a useful combat life.
Did you know what nationality were flying these PR2s?
No, I think they were probably North Koreans. I think the PO2 is a Russian airplane, I'm not too sure about that. But all hell was let loose when the American artillery opened up.
Did the PR2s cause much damage or casualties?
They didn't to us, no. They were just a nuisance, but they did actually succeed in dropping some bombs on an oil installation, which then burnt merrily for several days.
In what way was the MiG-15 so superior to the Meteor?
Both in speed, armament, and manoeuvrability, probably. Indeed, actually, at first, the 77 Squadron were equipped with the P-51 Mustang, and they attempted to mix it with the MiGs and came off second best, quite naturally. They re-equipped with Meteors. They thought they could take them on with the Meteor, and they suffered some losses. But they'd actually shoot one or two down. One Australian pilot actually fired his rockets at the MiG. Didn't hit it, but caused the MiG pilot to think a bit, and he then closed on him and shot him down with his cannon. So they did have successes, but General Barkus, I think, was the American general commanding 8th Air Force, said there isn't a target worth attacking in North Korea that's worth the loss of one of your aircraft to a MiG-15, so we never went far enough north to be bothered by them.
Why couldn't the MiG-15s be deployed further south?
A matter of range, I think. Because the F-86's Sabres that went up to the Yalu each day carried four drop tanks, four extra fuel tanks to get there.
How frightening were the operations in Korea?
I don't think frightening. That's rather a bit surprising when a hole appeared in the wing of my aeroplane, but no, I wouldn't say they were particularly frightening. There wasn't all that much ground fire. A little bit. Just see puffs of smoke. You know.
Did you have any sort of escape equipment that you took with you in case you were shot down?
Yes, indeed. We carried a barter pack of currency, things like ballpoint pens, small wristwatch, that sort of thing. Bribery, I suppose. Also a scarf with "Please don't kill me, I'm on your side and a lover of freedom" or something written on it in Chinese and in North Korean. And in the aircraft itself we had a morphine syringe mounted on the just below the cockpit window. In case we were wounded, we could give ourselves a shot of morphine.
Do you have any contact with the American Air Force?
Indeed, yes. The base we were on was an American base, K-14, Kimpo. One side of the airfield was the three F-86 Sabre fighter squadrons who went up to the Yalu twice a day. On our side of the airfield there were F-86 and F-80 reconnaissance aircraft and B-26 bombers and ourselves. So yes, indeed, we were victualled, we were operationally controlled by the Americans. I made a number of good friends amongst the American pilots. Also on the F-86 squadrons there were a number of RAF pilots as well. So we used to see them socially. So I met a number of the American aces, like Major DeBara, Major Fernandez, who are the great aces who shot down 15 plus MiGs.
What impression did you get of their method of operating?
They were pretty efficient, I think. Had to, as I said, take off with these four drop tanks to have the range to get up to the Yalu, but their kill ratio was pretty high. I think it's something like 8 or 9 to 1. They shot down a lot of MiGs. The other part of the operation, which was extremely efficient, was the rescue of shot down pilots. There were Sabres airborne all the time, whose job was, if a pilot was shot down, to go to the area immediately and shoot at any ground forces that attempt to approach the pilot. and then to allow a helicopter to come in and pick up the downed pilot. In fact, I believe that something like 40-some-odd% of all pilots shot down, including those killed, were picked up by helicopter. And there was another system where you were dropped two poles and some rope, and you stuck these in the ground, and the idea was that a Dakota flew across, dangling a hook underneath it, and picked you up on the end of your rope. You had a harness attached to the rope, picked you up off the ground. I don't know whether this is actually ever used, but it wouldn't be quite an exciting way to go, I suppose. What you had to do to land off the end of it, I've no idea. Dropped you in the sea, I suppose. But also off the west coast, north of the bomb line, there was an island called Chodo, which had a long beach, which would be acceptable for landing on, forced landing, at low water. So each day we were briefed on the times of low water at Chodo, in case we had to crash land and couldn't get back to base.
What exactly was the bomb line?
Where the ground forces were deployed against each other. It was pretty well static for some time beforehand. Along the Imjin River, for example, where the Gloucesters had their battle.
Did you see anything of the operations of the Fleet Air Arm in Korea?
No, we didn't, actually. They operated from the carriers off the west coast. HMS Ocean, I think, was one of them. We did actually have a rendezvous to take a photograph of the Australian South African Air Force, because they had a Sabre squadron, F-86 squadron there, and the Royal Navy in formation. But the Royal Navy never turned up, so the photographs regrettably only contained the Meteor and the F-86 South African Sabres.
Why didn't they turn up?
I don't know. They never did discover that. Either they went to the wrong place or we did.